growing up where I grew up or how I grew up, like you watch your family do the hard stuff anyway. I mentioned my mom, she worked at that corner store for 29 years. She's getting up every day. Her shift begins at like 4 a.m. or whatever. So she's going and doing that. My dad has been driving a city bus at this point for 33 years. Same thing. He's up every morning, 3 o'clock, to be down there by 3:45 to do whatever. Like you, I'm watching my people do that. My uncles do that. My aunts do that. And it's like, oh, like I don't have to get up and go dig a fucking trench. You're telling me I just got to send 45 emails today? Like I can do that, no problem.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I'm a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. The whole idea behind these conversations, behind this podcast, is to learn from people who have committed their life efforts towards mastery. And we want to better understand, how do they organize their inner life? How do they use their mind to build and refine their craft? And how do they use their mind to build and refine their understanding of what's possible for them? Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with Shay Serrano. He's an author and a journalist, and how he's become is incredible. His books include The Rap Year Book, Basketball and Other Things, and Movies and Other Things. And all three were New York Times bestsellers. And two of them were number one on the list, and one was picked by Barack Obama as one of his favorite books of the year. Man, how cool is that? Shay's a legend. And this conversation, it's real. And Shay used to be a teacher. He loved it. He couldn't afford to take care of his family. So he had to figure out some kind of way to figure that out. And it led him to writing. Shay's story is, well, it's about perseverance. It's about having a vision. It's about one step in front of the other. It's about having purpose. It's about competing, like flat out competing with yourself to take those next steps, even when they're difficult, even when you're in deep waters and it's hard to figure out the right step. And I'll tell you what, sometimes you got to push fear aside. Sometimes you got to understand it, embrace it. Sometimes you got to swallow it. Sometimes you got to wink at it, nod at it. But he understands how to work with fear. And when it comes to the writing process, there's definitely fear involved. Like, of all the words in your native tongue, choosing the right words that capture the ideas that you understand most, and to do it in a way that you get the simplicity of it, but never abandon the depth. And so in Shay's words,
once I start typing, I like read the stuff that I'm writing and I go, oh, I think this is pretty cool. This is like kind of good. And then you feel like that the whole time you're working on it. By the end of the whatever it is I'm writing, I swear it's the best thing that's ever been written, like in the history of words. Then as soon as you turn it in, you get terrified because now other people are going to see it. If you care about the thing, you're inside of you going to be worried about when somebody tells you they don't care about it or that it sucks.
And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Shay Serrano. Shay, how you doing?
What up, boy?
Yeah. You start with some fire, huh? You live with fire, don't you?
I live with three children. So at the moment, yes, a house full of fire.
I love how you think differently, dude. This is why I wanted to have this conversation with you. Because all right. you think differently. I think you see the world differently. I think that your experiences are so dynamic and risk-taking, you know, that and bold that I'm super excited to have this conversation with you.
I think you're hyping me up a little too much. I'm excited for like everybody to, by the end of this, be like, that was fucking very regular.
Very regular. Okay, good. All right, sometimes the average is strikingly interesting. So let's see what we have here. Okay, so let's start with a frame. If you could, let's say, how many chapters of your life have you had? Let's say the book is not finished, okay? But how many chapters have you had in your life?
I would say the chapter headings are chapter one. This is going to cover all of like being a kid and growing up and then getting into college, because it was like the first person in my family to go to college. Like, this was like a big thing. I was like, within our group, there was nothing that I could do wrong at this moment. Once I got in, they're like, oh shit, he made it. So that would be like chapter one. He like, Shay gets into college. Chapter two would be Shay meets Laramie, because Laramie was really like, I don't know, without Laramie, none of this shit works. She's just the centerpiece of everything. She's like the person I go to with whatever it is that I have to go to somebody with. So Shay meets Laramie. Number three, Shay becomes a dad. When the twins are born, everything became very real in that moment. Like the pregnancy complications that Laramie had, 4 months into the pregnancy, she goes into labor. They're telling us the kids are gonna die. This is very, very quickly a grow up moment. You're 26, 27 years old. I've never been through anything like that before with like stakes that high. Legit, oh shit, time to become a grown up. So Shay goes to college, Shay meets Laramie, Shay has kids, Shay becomes a writer, because that changed the whole trajectory of like my professional life. And then I guess the last one is going to be Shay dies. The men in my family have died early. Like my dad right now is 57, and that's the oldest we've ever gotten. Every day is like he sets a new record. So I would guess if I'm 39, I'm like 80% of the way done. Like I'm almost out of here. Would be a guess. I hope not. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm one of those like old Mexicans that you see, they pop up on Twitter and it's like, this person celebrating their 104th birthday and their skin just looks like a fucking boot. Like that's what I want to be, but I'm just guessing the opposite way.
Okay, so let's pause there. So there's this insight that about vision, holding a vision for yourself. And Coach Carroll taught this to me, head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. He was doing some work with some folks and he learned very quickly. This was inner city conversations with people that were struggling, right? So he was purposely going into communities where families were struggling, not communities, mm-hmm. but the family was struggling. And he said, you know what? It hit him. That there was this idea that I'm either going to go to jail or die trying.
Right.
You know, I'm going to die early or I'm going to be in jail. And he said, Mike, that's a vision. That's the vision they hold for themselves. So of course they're going to make it real in some respects. Mm-hmm. It's going to come to fruition. So let me hold that idea for you. Like, what is the vision for your age? Like, is it foggy or is it like 120, 101, 75, 58? Like, where are you in that vision?
When you say vision, you're talking about like, how long do I think I'm going to live?
Well, yeah, but it's like really about your future. You know, like, do you see yourself living a full long life or a full short life?
Because your history. I hope it's a full long life. Shit. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to mm-hmm. end up doing whatever my dad did is my guess. You know, maybe like the goal here is his dad died very early on. He's outlived him. Maybe I will outlive mine and my sons will outlive me. The length I'm referring to here. So, you know, I'm just going to sort of follow what he does. Let's take wherever he passes away, whatever age he is when my father dies, let's add 7 years to that. And that's going to be the goal. So minimum right now, my goal is 64.
Can I get into it with you here?
I would love that.
Why not? Why not say 22 years? Why not say 50 years? Why not extend it like further? Why seven?
Well, I think this is the same as like if you're exercising and you're like, I'm going to do some push-ups. How many do you think you could do? I don't know. Why would I say 1,000 push-ups? Some ridiculous number that doesn't feel feasible. Like I'm going to give up quicker if you tell me to do 1,000 push-ups versus if you say like do 31 push-ups. I probably can't do 31 push-ups right now, but I'm going to try harder to get to that number because it's like, oh, it's closer. You know what I'm saying? So if I I'm going to try to live to be 64. That seems like something I could do. Like if I exercise a little bit and live slightly healthier, I could probably get to 64. And then, you know, maybe I can get to 65 now or 67. It seems silly to be like, oh, I want to be 120. Like I'm not fucking Rob Lowe from Parks and Rec. You know what I'm saying? Like that's not me.
Yeah. You know what? I appreciate the way you're responding because it's like, listen, I'm going to base my assessment of my future on my history, what I've seen, like frameworks that are real. And my family tends to die young. And yeah. I made up a story that it's about disease or health, but I don't know if is that accurate?
Heart attacks mostly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So then can I double click on this one more time?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So let's say you get to that age, will you level up 2 years or will you level up another seven? What do you think you'll do at 65?
If my dad died today and my goal was 64, 65 and I got to 64, 65, I would keep pressing because at that, if I get to 64, then that means my kids are now in their 30s or something like that. And that means they probably have kids. I get to be a grandpa for a while. So yeah, I think, you know, just try to find some stuff to stick around for as those days come.
What is your life pursuit? Like, what are you pursuing in life?
Money is like the answer here because that's the like, not necessarily like the main thing, but it's what I need to get to the main thing. The main thing here is I just want to take care of my people. That's all it is. I've got like a very close a group around me, a group of family members around me, and I would like to be responsible for like them having a better life. That's been the whole goal with all of this stuff. And it starts out small. It starts out Laramie and I, we have three kids. So you're like, okay, first we need to, this is a conversation Laramie and I have had. I'm like, okay, the first thing we need to do is we need to make sure like that the boys are taken care of. If something terrible were to happen, like what have we left for them at this moment right now? So we're just slowly building that up, building that up, building that up. And then once we got to a spot where we felt like, okay, the boys are good here. All right, let's open this up a little bit. Now, let me talk to my mom. And I'm like, mom, my mom worked at a corner store at a gas station for 29 years. And it was like, ma, you don't have to do this job anymore if you don't want to. We can take care of you now. And she's like, all right, cool. She quits the job. So now we're taking care of her, buy her a little house, buy her a car, like pay all of her bills. She's good to go. And it's like, okay, cool. Once we've done that, let's go to dad. Dad, do you want to retire now? Cool. Let's set all of that stuff up. All right. You two are taken care of. Now let me go to I've got three younger sisters. And I'm like, all right, let me go to the first one and be like, okay, are you good? Let's take care of you and your kids. You know what I'm saying? Like slowly, slowly opening that up. So when I say my goal here is money, like I need the money to do the things I want to do because that makes me feel good.
Yeah. So purpose is taking care of other people, right?
Yeah, and that sounds right.
Yeah. Okay. And then what is that threshold? Like what is taking care of your three kids? Is this like a yacht? Each of them has their own.
Oh, no, you know, no.
Right. No, like, I know I'm being silly, but like, yeah. what's the taking care of look like for you in your mind and heart?
The taking care of for me looks like the first main thing was if they want to go to college, let's have that taken care of. Because Laramie and I both have student loans that we are still to this day paying down. It's like, it'd be great if they didn't have to worry about that. So we set that up for each of the boys and we like put money in there until we can like get enough that it would pay for if they want to do 4 years out of whatever school at UTSA, which is right down the road. It's like, all right, we've got that. The next thing is like, is there a way to set up a trust that will pay them a certain amount every month for however many years? That way, if they get into a spot where if there's a job they want to do but doesn't provide for them the way it needs to provide, they can do that job without worry of the other part. Before I was a writer, I was a teacher. I did this for 9 years. I taught at a middle school in South Houston, and I loved it. It was one of those jobs where you start doing it, and you go like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. It was one of those. And then life started to happen for me and for Laramie, and you realize, oh, you can't take care of a family of four, a family of five on teacher salaries, making 40-something thousand a year maybe. Like $1,100 every 2 weeks was the paycheck. And I couldn't do it anymore. I was like, well, you know, writing was paying me way more than teaching. So I had to move over to writing. If I could just like decide and do all of the stuff I'm doing now, but I could teach while doing it, like that would be what I would want to do. And I would like for that to be an option for the boys. If one of the boys is like, oh, I want to work at a nonprofit to do whatever, to help this community, but they're only going to pay me $31,000 a year or something to do this. Like you can't live off of that. So it'd be cool if there was like, oh, every month I get $3,000 paid to me that pays for the bills for most of them. And I can do the job that I want to do. Like we don't need to be rich. I don't need for them to be millionaires. I just need for them to do the thing they want to do with their life. That's what I feel like I owe that responsibility to them.
I figured in not such eloquent ways that you would say that because I think that when, from a distance, the way I've been tracking your arc is that you did just that, but you mm-hmm. didn't have the net that you want to provide to your kids. Right. Yeah. And so in your language, you were broke.
That sounds right.
And so walk me through, this is a big deal to me. Okay. So I don't want to be light on any of this. Like in my mind, I'm not light. You can take us any direction you want, but like, mm-hmm. what is it like? First of all, what is your heritage? How do you identify?
I'm Mexican. I guess technically Mexican-American. Both of my parents are Mexican.
Okay. My father-in-law has educated me about the hyphen. And so he came to America with $20 in his pocket at age 15. And he says, Mike, they've never allowed me to be fully American because I've always been Latin American. And mm-hmm. he's a man of full agency. He's like, yeah, right. That's the way that he's got full agency. He ended up like crushing his experience in life. That being said, what is it like? I want to know, so Mexican American. Okay. So frame that in just a moment. Let's go into what was it like for you to be Mexican American, broke, and then get into this position where you're like, I'm going to change, but there's no net underneath of me. And I could be overdramatic. And so chin check me if I'm wrong here.
Yeah, it was not anything as dramatic as that. That's not like a conversation you have with yourself. You don't think about, and two parts here, you don't think about being Mexican American until you are around people who are not that. Like, I grew up on the south side of San Antonio. Every room that I walked into, every classroom, every barbershop, every restaurant looked like me. Every person in there, it's largely Hispanic, 90-something% Hispanic on that side of town. So it's like, oh, there are lots of Serranos and there are lots of brown eyes and there are lots of shaved heads with the goatee and the tattoos or whatever. Like that's what everybody looks like. I leave to go to college and all of a sudden the population there is the school was like 15,000 kids. I think there were maybe like 100 Mexicans there, like total. So it was really a culture shock to walk out of one school, you know, Southwest High School, predominantly Hispanic, go to this new school and all of a sudden it's like mostly white. There's a large black population, a smaller Asian population, but I think Latino was the smallest of all of the subgroups or somewhere near there. So you don't start thinking about it until then. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Then it becomes like a part of your life when you realize, oh, shit is a little bit different. I met Laramie. Laramie is black. And like even all of these years later, we've been together 20 years, there's still like differences that we have in our cultures where like we approach things with a different set of eyes. So again, this is not something you think about until you have to think about it. It's the same with money. You grow up and everybody's poor. Oh, this is just what it looks like. Oh, cool. Like your family is in jail this week, so is mine. Like that sort of situation, you know? And then you get out of that and you realize like, oh shit, Laramie's family is not poor. And you go to her, I go to her house for the first time and they've got like these big front doors and everything looks so elegant. And it's like, oh shit, all your furniture matches. And like, you know what I'm saying? Like it just looked different. You don't have to confront those ideas until you have to confront those ideas. That's all that it was. There was no like grand plotting or anything. Somebody opened a door and I looked in there and I said, oh, that looks nice. Like I want my space to look more like that. How do I do that? And then you just start chasing shit down.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to Hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydro.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. Okay, so I want to get to the part where you took a risk. And maybe you're saying the risk wasn't dramatic, but I just love the idea that you've fundamentally changed the way that your family structure worked from the way you grew up to mm-hmm. the way it is now. I think that that's one of the significantly difficult things to do for most humans is to move like up a level, if you will, you know,
right.
or expand your opportunities. So can you teach on that a little bit and even tell me a story like about the exact intersection where you decided to make some changes?
You know, I wish that I had like a really cool tale to give about like how I put in motion this great big plan of how like 5 years later it's going to look different. But that was not the case at all. The way that it worked for me was I was teaching, Laramie was teaching, she got pregnant with the twins, she couldn't work anymore. All of a sudden we only had one salary that to live on, and you realize very quickly these numbers don't fit. We have too much in the bill column and not enough in the income column. I need to like float us until she can get back to work about 6 months later. And so it's like, all right, I need to make $400 extra a month. How can I do that? I started applying to work at like, can I work at Target? Can I work at a grocery store? Can I be a waiter at a different restaurant? And I went on a few interviews, and each of the interviews, they were like, oh, we can't hire you because you already have a full-time job. You can't work when we need you to work. So like, this isn't going to work out. Like, all right, well, that fucking sucks. So I'm at home Googling work from home jobs. Writer was one of them. And I click on it, and I'm reading through the list, and it's like, oh, all you need to be a writer is like the internet and a computer, and then you can be a writer. There you go. So I said, well, I have both of those things. Let me try to do that. And then I just start researching. We're living in Houston at the time. I like grab every local Houston newspaper that I can get. I'm looking through, finding who editors are. I'm just emailing people, trying to like figure out a way in, because again, I'm not trying to change my career. I love teaching. I want to be teaching. I'm just trying to make an extra $400 a month or whatever the number is. And you know, I get like my first article in this little tiny, it's called the Near Northwest Banner. It was like a legitimate newsletter that this woman and man were printing up in their garage and then like handing out to people in the neighborhood. And they paid me $15 to write about the Texans for them. And I did that. And then I wrote one about the Astros. And then I took those two pieces to the Houston Press. And it was like, hey, look, I'm a writer for real. I've written for papers. Can I write for y'all? And then I was like able to make friends with this guy who connected me to an editor there. And then I started working there. And it just kept going like that each time. You know, you get in a spot, you get a couple assignments in, you like spread your wings a little bit, and then you take those to whatever the next bigger spot is. So I'm like, okay, cool. I went from the Houston Press. Now I'm going to pitch like LA Weekly or the Village Voice. And then when I get in there, I'm like, all right, cool. Now I can pitch MTV or Rolling Stone or ESPN. And you're just slowly working your way up, not really thinking too far ahead. You're just like, what's the next thing that I can do to make a little bit more money? And then that's when like all of a sudden it's 2 years later and you look around and you're making not a ton, but maybe like $2,000 a month freelance writing. And you're like, oh shit, I make $2,200 a month teaching full time, $2,000 a month freelancing part time. Maybe there's a way that I can like do more of this. And then I got like my first job offer to go work at ESPN, and I took like a part-time contract for that. And then that became a full-time thing. And it just, you know, things just kept happening in that path. Like one little thing each time. It's like that's literally how you climb a ladder, is fucking one rung at a time. You don't fucking go from the bottom straight to the top. You know what I'm saying?
I'm so glad that we talked about this, because I had a different thought about how you did it. And mm-hmm. And what you just described is actually my path as well, which is like most people don't know this about me, but for years, my first office was in a janitor's closet in an old school that had no windows. And and that's where I would see, you know, I was starting to work my craft a little bit and I was having to chase out rats. There was a rat problem in the office. So, right. Like awesome. It's not glamorous at all. Awesome. You know? No. And it was just like, and then, you know, there was a little, I did some good work and it kind of clicked. And then there was an introduction to another person and another, and just kind of kept expanding in these very small ways. Mm-hmm. But I see myself as somebody who has high work ethic and high agency, meaning that I can co-create an experience with environments and people. And I'm not like at the whip's end of whatever they want. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that I'm just creating whatever it is that I want. It's a co-creation. And I'm hearing that word agency for you, right? Like the sense that you can make a difference in a space. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say now. Now I have some confidence in that capacity. At the time, though, no, I was just doing whatever somebody told me to do to get like an extra $40.
What made you believe that you could go from a $40 gig to an $80 gig? Like, what made you believe that you could actually take those steps once you got into those rooms?
Yeah, once you get into the rooms, you realize the people who are in there, you sort of build them up in your head. That they're just like these mythic creatures who, whatever, they have some sort of unnamed talent or skill that you don't have. And then you get in the rooms and you talk to the people and you realize like, oh, There are definitely people in any industry who are just innately more talented than everybody else. That will always be the case. We're talking about writing. Like, I can name you five writers. Like Sean Fennessy, for example. You read his stuff and you go like, oh, you were born to do this. Wesley Morris, Gia Tolentino, like these characters. You read their stuff and you go like, I could never do what they do ever. But that's a small, small percentage of the people who make up the writing industry. All of the rest of them, we're all working with like the same skill set. It's just a matter of like, who's going to knock on the door the loudest? Who's going to stand there the longest? Who's going to try the hardest? And once I've realized like, that's all that this is just like a straight up endurance challenge. Oh, I'm fucking good. I can't run fast, but I can run for a long time. You know what I'm saying? And that's just what it felt like.
Okay. All right. So that is like this internal skill of perseverance, of effort, if you will, a sense of resiliency to bounce around and forward, hopefully mm-hmm. when it gets hard. And then, what gives you the right, and I don't mean this in an aggressive way, but what gives you that what gives you the right to say, I can go for a long time. I can do hard things. Like, how do you back that up inside of yourself? Because obviously you have the external, arc that I even like that I've been able to watch. You're like, oh shit, look at that. Mm-hmm, you know, so like but internally, what gives you the right to say, no, I can do hard things?
I would guess because growing up where I grew up or how I grew up, like you watch your family do the hard stuff anyway. Like this is, I mentioned my mom, she worked at that corner store for 29 years. She's getting up every day. Her shift begins at like 4 a.m. or whatever. She's going and doing, doing that. My dad has been driving a city bus at this point for 33 years. Same thing. He's up every morning, 3 o'clock, to be down there by 3:45 to do whatever. Like you, I'm watching my people do that. My uncles do that. My aunts do that. And it's like, oh, like I don't have to get up and go dig a fucking trench. You're telling me I just got to send 45 emails today? Like I can do that, no problem. This is it's different.
So this is part of your family DNA, right? Hard work. And so, okay, I don't know if this is, I'm trying to figure out this racism, anti-racism space. Like I'm really at a very contemplative place trying to sort it out. And what is it like right now with your wife being black, and you being brown? What is that like for you?
It's not any different, really, if you like, you know what I'm saying? It's not anything. This was not like some great revelation when people realized, oh, like there's a lot of foul shit happening right now. Because for me, it's been happening for my whole life. For Laramie, it's been happening in her whole life. Like, you just see it all of the time. It's cool that like a lot of these ideas are being confronted now. A lot of the, like, there's an acknowledgement. There seems to be, maybe it's just the people who I follow on Twitter, you always have to account for that, but there seems to be an acknowledgement that people are realizing the structure of the United States of America is set up as such that lives of non-white people are regarded as less than. And it's cool to, like, watch this become a big thing. We're in the middle of a civic movement that we have not seen in like 50 or 60 years. Like, this is a big thing that's happening right now. So, like, you know, to be alive during this particular moment is cool. It sucks, but it's also, you know, less sucky than if we were all ignoring it.
Yeah. So on the idea, the movement, the center of the movement was Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as somebody says, well, brown lives matter, it becomes, is that a dilution of this, the epicenter of the experience of being Black in America? Is that racist? Are you trying to shed a little bit here from the actual core issue? And so my wife is going back and forth a little bit, like, this is epic. And then the other thought, which is like, yeah, you know, like, brown is not included yet. And I wonder if it will be. And, you know, but it's like this, it's a small note, but I'm wondering what that's like for you.
I would say that's a tricky question to answer on the surface, but ultimately, ultimately it's very easy. There is no experience that you can liken to being Black in America. There's just not.
Period.
There's no, like, conversation to be had about that. I don't know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to be Mexican in America. That's it. That's all that I know. Same as you know what it feels like to be white in America. And we can be like, we can commiserate, me and like Laramie can commiserate over like certain versions of shared experiences. But ultimately, I can never know what it feels like to look at the news and see a thing and be like, oh, this looks like me. In the capacity that she can. So I don't think there's ever a reason to respond to the phrase Black Lives Matter with any other version of that thing. Like, it's just, that's not what this is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
So that's, you know, that's a conversation that Laramie and I have had on very few occasions because we both sort of understand the differences here. It wasn't like when all of the, like, news was focused on the family separations at the borders, she wasn't like, oh, but don't forget about the police shooting. Like, these things can all exist at the same time. You know what I'm saying? We can confront all of these ideas at the same time. We don't have to, like, try to always include every single part of every single thing into these moments. Like, don't do that.
That's what's up right there, is that we can hold space, we can hold the container to do and stand for all things that are of injustice. How about it?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, right? That's the idea, that we can hold that space and we can take action in each one of those, whether it's the ones you mentioned or trafficking and or, right?
Yeah, but right now, there are 1,000 of them. There are 1,000 versions of this story. There are endless groups of people who are being oppressed for whatever reason. We don't have to, you know, acknowledging that we are specifically talking about one thing at one particular moment doesn't minimize anything else. If anything, it, like, increases the validity of everything.
What do you think the most important step is to close the racial divide?
I think a lot of the onus here is going to fall on white people, honestly. And I don't know if that's like a sacrifice most of them are willing to make, because we can, you know, the other side of it, we can fuss and, like, make our points known and tell you all of the things, but, you know, think on it like, here's a sloppy metaphor. If you've got like two kids playing and one kid has 9 toys and the other one has 2 toys, ultimately the kid with nine is going to have to decide to give some of the toys away to the other one. That's where we are, I think, with things. Like, we are being very loud and very clear about the injustices that are occurring, and you know, now is the time for some of y'all to hand over some of y'all's toys.
And those toys in the metaphor are seats at tables, right? Like positions of influence and decision making.
Yeah. That works. You know, I think we all have a role to play in this situation. My role is not like the legislation of reform. That's not me. I'm just like, an idea will pop up and I'll go like, oh, that seems like a good idea. We should maybe, let's try that. I'll support that. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's where I am.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being. But it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Okay, so I'm wondering if you're hinting at how you write. And because
What a pivot.
Like, this is your mind. But this is your mind, right? Okay. And maybe tell me if I'm off here. But like, when I look at your headlines and your taglines, they're awesome, dude. They're straight from the heart, they're clear, they're concise. And there's definitely a theme involved in it, you know, like FOH, you know, like walk us through how FOH came up to be. Walk us through, like, you know, just some of the taglines and how you come up with them.
Okay, so it always feels weird to me to explain like things that happen on Twitter away from Twitter, because there's no way to do it without sounding insane. With regard to the FOH, that's shorthand for the phrase fuck out of here, which is shorthand for the phrase get the fuck out of here. This started as like a silly rallying cry in 2015. The way it happened is I had my first like real book was coming out, and when you like put a book out, a publisher will determine how many copies of the book they're going to print up in the beginning. And if they think it won't sell a lot, they print up a few, and there you go. That's like the background information you need. But so the book is coming out, and I was trying to get people to buy the book. I'm on Twitter. I think I maybe have like 40,000 people following me at the time. And I'm like, oh, go buy the book from this bookstore today. And there you go. Some people went and bought the book, and we end up like selling out at that store, because that store maybe had 6 copies of the book or 3 copies of the book. Like, but it sounds cool to be like, oh, we bought all the copies at this book, because everybody assumes there's fucking 1,000 copies at every store. So we go to the next, we're like, when they tell us that they've sold out, we move to the next store and we like sell out there. And then we're like, oh, let's get them from Amazon. And we sell out on Amazon. And we're just sort of going around, and somebody makes the joke that we are like a shitty version of an army, just sort of going around causing trouble at different places, because like a store's website crashed a couple of times. And then somebody gave it the name, the FOH Army. That's where the tag name came from, because it was like a joke. Like people were saying nobody was going to buy the book, and we're telling them, get the fuck out of here. We're going to go buy the book. You know, it was something silly like that. Like, this is just me trying to remember it from 5 years ago. But that's how it started. And then like a year later or so, this is October of 2015. So the book had come out, and then I was writing full time at this moment. And the place where I was working, this place named Grantland, closed down. They just shut down. They're out of here forever. And I had signed a 1-year contract. So I still have 8 months on my contract to sort of do whatever I want. And they're going to pay me my paychecks every 2 weeks. So we start, I say we, me and Arturo Torres, this the illustrator of all my books, him and I start a newsletter to just like stay practiced, because I wasn't writing anywhere and he wasn't drawing anywhere. So we start this illustrated newsletter, and it's like supposed to be just a silly little thing, but after a week or two, we have, you know, 30,000 people subscribe to it. And people are asking, you know, you're putting this out for free. Let, you know, can I send you $1? Can I send you $2? Blah, blah, blah. We became like this running joke because we kept telling them no. And then finally, after 4 weeks of doing this, we put a donation button in one of the newsletters and we sent it out. And then like that morning, we had like $4,000, $5,000 or whatever it was just sort of showed up in our PayPal account or Venmo or whichever one it was. And we had talked about it beforehand because I was still getting a check from my job. I didn't know if I was like breaking rules by taking money from somewhere else, so I didn't want the money. Arturo was freelancing, so I was like telling him, I don't pay you very much for the art. Let me give you like $1,000, $1,500 or something. He's like, all right, cool. So we did that. And then we sent the rest to the shelter in Dallas that he spent some time in as a kid, him and his mom and his brothers, called the Genesis Woman Shelter. So we sent the rest of the money to there. And then we posted screenshots of it on Twitter. We're like, here's how much money we got. Here's what I gave Arturo. Here's where I sent the rest of it. Like, surprise, you guys, you dummies accidentally donated to this place. And everybody made like a big fuss about it. Oh, that's so cool. You like gave away money, blah, blah, blah. And that's how it started. And that was, you know, I think maybe 2016, maybe late 2015, something like that. And it just sort of grew from there. We did it again a few weeks later, and then we donated it to another place. And then it was like, we realized very quickly, we could just be like, hey, give us some money and we'll donate it. And people start sending money in. And it started out as like small things, like $1,000, $3,000, $5,000. And then like the first real actual big one that we did was when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston. And, you know, the neighborhood that I lived in flooded, and there was like a lot of crazy shit going on. And we were stranded outside of Houston at the time, and I didn't know what to do. So I was just like, I guess send me some money and I'll get it to the places in Houston that are helping. And in like 8 or 9 hours, we had $130,000+, like more money than I'd ever seen in my account in my life. And I panicked And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm going to prison. The IRS is going to get me. This is awful. I like tried to turn it off real fast. I don't want nobody send me any more money. I don't know what to do. And then thankfully, the people at Venmo and PayPal reached out. And they're like, we saw this activity. What's going on? I explained to them what it was. And they go, oh, cool, we can help with that. This guy named Josh Crisco, I'll never forget him. He was like, I got you. Just tell me where you want the money to go and I'll get it to them. And now I don't even have to like take it out of my Venmo account. It just goes straight into the nonprofits. But we did that. And then it just became like a thing. And now it's like, anytime we're going to donate money to a place, I go like, all right, I'm in for $50. Y'all can send in money if you want. And it's like a bunch of $5, $10 donations. And it always adds up to a ton. Like, just during when all of this like fucking coronavirus shit happened, we started doing this on March 12th. Over like a 2 or 3 month stretch, we donated, you know, $250,000 to $260,000 of just straight cash to different places, different people, just off of these like little donations. But that's what the FOH is. That's all that it is. It's just like a bunch of people on the internet who will send in $5 when we need it.
It's awesome. I mean, the whole thing is like, it's an accident that took place, but really it was based on a decision or a mindset or a philosophy that you had, which is, hey, money is to do good for others. And it was question number one from jump. That's what you said. Like, your pursuit is for money, but the purpose is to do good for others. Uh-huh. And then you are not complicated in the approach that you said, well, when I had some money, I stayed true to my purpose and right. I gave it to these, you know, these organizations. And so again, I want to pivot back to mindset or philosophy, you know, and in that, because yours seems really clear to me. And it's marked by the consistency of the tone of which you write in, but also the actions that you consistently take. And so, like, does mindset precede change, you know, systematic change? Or do you think an accident happens and then you're forced to change your mindset? And I'm loaded the way I think about this, and I'll share my opinion, but how do you see that?
I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe at some point inside of everybody's body, there's like an urge or a voice telling you to do something. That's hard to speak to. That's hard to address. When I look back at it, it very much feels like an accident. We weren't anticipating to like take money for the newsletter, for example. And then once we saw people wanted to do it, we didn't say, oh, we should donate money. It'll be like a good thing to do. We legit were like, oh, you know what would be fucking funny is if we took this money and then like the Joker in Batman, we just didn't do anything. We set it on fire somehow. Let's just give it away to a plate. That's what it was. It wasn't like, oh, I feel like I'm a good person. Let me go do a good thing. It wasn't that. It was like, it was this other thing. We just thought it would be a clever, funny thing to do. And then it became like a thing people were expecting us to do. So we just started doing it.
So is your part of your life approach, is it, and this is more tonal or stylistic, if you will, is it an irreverent, off-axis, funny, like the Joker thing, right? Or is it serious and intense and purposeful? I would love to hear in your words the style that you come from, because your purpose is clear. But you've got, this is why I was stoked to talk to you. Like, you got a really cool style. And so I'd like to hear how you describe your approach, your style.
My approach or my style to like being alive?
Life, yeah. your craft included. Because that's how I first met you, right? Like through your craft.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. So all I want to do is like just make some cool shit with people I like. Professionally, that's like the whole thing that I want to do. If I like meet somebody, oh, you're cool. Like, you want to do a thing. I saw Arturo's artwork and I was like, hey, we should do, let's do a thing together. And then we started working together. Or I like might try to pitch a TV show with somebody. I'm like, oh, you're cool. You want to do like a thing. Let's try a thing and see what happens. So that's like professionally, that's my whole thing. I think outside of that, just like as a general mode of existence, I want to try to do as much stuff as possible, but I don't want to take credit for any of it. I want to be like in the background being like, this is just like some shit I got lucky and it worked out and like, cool, let's let's keep it moving. We don't need to talk about much more beyond that, if that makes sense.
Is that your form of humility?
Yeah. I'm trying to be as humble as possible because I'm not like any of the shit that I'm doing. I have not like invented anything or created anything. I'm just doing a thing somebody else has already done. I didn't like invent writing or a style of writing or anything like that. I'm just doing it in a way that feels good to me. And then like some other people respond to it because it feels good to them. Some people hate it. I see it on the internet all the time. This guy fucking, his writing is terrible. How does he, I see that. I like, that's just what it is. But some people do respond to it and you know.
When you see that, so let's imagine there's space. There's like, I don't know. There's not really a container for thoughts, right? But let's just say that you got 18 hours or 14 hours you're awake, whatever it is, and there's a container for those thoughts that you can possibly have. Mm-hmm. How much of those thoughts that you allocate throughout the day are towards like, I just want to do cool things with great people, you know, and versus what I think takes up a lot of space for people is what are they thinking about what I'm doing? So,
Yeah.
I'd like to know how you deal with that space about what are they thinking about me?
I try to not spend energy at all on that thing. It's impossible to like avoid all of it, but I do a very good job of like, I don't Google my name. I don't read reviews. You can usually tell from a headline if like somebody's saying some nice shit about you. And I might like, if I see it, skim it. Or like they wrote about the movie book, the last book I did in the New York Times. And I was incredibly nervous because I heard they were going to do it beforehand. And so like I read that one and I read it with like squinted eyes to see, are they going to shred me apart? And fortunately they said like nice things about it and felt really, really great. But mostly I just avoid all of that stuff. I don't search my name on Twitter. I don't read the reviews on Amazon or anything like that. Like, I don't want to see any of it. I don't want people to bring it to my doorstep.
Okay. So that's your strategy.
Mm-hmm.
What it comes before that? I'm imagining, I don't want to fill in the holes here, but I'm imagining the strategy is to put it to the side and squint and not look and not have it be at your doorstep. So not be part of it.
Yeah.
But what becomes before that? Like, it's really hard. It's too triggering. It's too open wounded when are. Is that what comes before for you?
Yeah, there's no way to not think about that stuff, about like what people are going to say about a thing. But I've been doing this at this point for 10 years or so, 12 years, something like that. Like you just get good at compartmentalizing it. It's like a like if you're skydiving, have you ever been skydiving?
I have.
Surely you have. You look like, you have a face like I've done some skydiving in my life. Like you just, I could see your fucking, your very thick hair flickering in the, like you look great in a pic, great in a skydiving picture. Anyways, I've gone skydiving twice in my life. I wanted to see what it was like. And then I went, Laramie wanted to do it after that. But you're terrified. You're 100% terrified in the airplane. As it like circles its way up into the sky, they fucking open that door and then it's just like chaos inside the airplane. You're 100% absolutely terrified, but your body still goes because you take that fear, you move it a little bit to the side. You don't disappear it. It doesn't like ever leave. You're nervous before every basketball game, but you still go out there and you try and you still like jump out of the airplane. Or whatever. It's the same thing here. Like every time I sit down to write a thing, I'm like terrified that it's going to suck and people are going to read it and they're going to tell me that it sucks. But I can't worry about that because if I don't write it, then they don't give me any money and then I can't pay for everything.
How do you manage that moment? Because it sounds to me like the fear of other people's opinions is important, is a big fear, or it's a fear that you recognize. If you could take me into how you wrestle with that. Like in that moment when you're staring at a blank screen, how do you work with that fear?
Just what we're talking about. You just move it. You're like, all right, I'm scared, but let me put in this box over here for a few minutes and let me start typing. And then once I start typing, I like read the stuff that I'm writing and I go, oh, I think this is pretty cool. This is like kind of good. And then you feel like that the whole time you're working on it. By the end of the whatever it is I'm writing, I swear it's the best thing that's ever been written, like in the history of words. then as soon as you turn it in, you get terrified because now other people are going to see it. But yeah, you just move it to the side a little bit and then give it a go.
Okay. Okay. I love it because you make it super simple. Like I recognize that thought. I recognize that feeling. I just kind of shift it. I put in a box, like you'll deal with it later type of thing. So you're not consumed with it in this moment. But then you know what I heard you say? Is then I fall in love. I fall in love with the choices I'm making. Not like a self-love, but I'm falling in love with this thing I'm trying to explain or express. Yeah. And I'm making these little choices and I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, no, 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 no. Wait, hold on. And then so there's this iterative kind of thing and you fall in love with it because I'm putting that lens on there because as soon as you press send, you ship it off, then that fear comes back up like, man, if hold on, I got too many thoughts in my head because if you didn't love it, there'd be no fear, right? Because you're like, this is shit. Let me see if I can get over on them. It's totally different than, boy, this feels really amazing. Oh my God, what if they don't love my baby? What if they think my baby is ugly? That type of thing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. If you care about the thing, you're you know, inside of you going to be worried about when somebody tells you they don't care about it or that it sucks.
Okay, so let's pull on that thread a little bit about vulnerability. Because that's a moment of vulnerability. Are you skilled? How do you do vulnerability? Are you like, no, I don't do any of that? Or it's like, no, what I just said, even saying it was vulnerable. Like, can you talk about vulnerability for a moment?
I guess I could talk about vulnerability. It doesn't feel like I think anything more needs to be said about it. Because ultimately, all that this is you're scared and you just admit that you're scared and then you keep it moving. Like, it doesn't seem like that big of a thing to me.
I love that. But, you know, but that's your frame. For a lot of people, what other people think of them keeps them constricted and tight, and it doesn't allow them to express themselves in any way. And you're saying, no, fear is fear. Like, I'm scared. I just got to say it. It's human. But so that's your frame. This is a very powerful way to go through life, which is, no, I got fear. Yep. It's hard, but I got it.
It's silly to argue that you don't. I mean, maybe there's somebody out there. Maybe this is like, did you ever see that movie, what's it called, On Earth or something Earth with Will Smith, when he like doesn't experience fear? Like, maybe there's somebody like that, but that's not me. And I don't want to try to like pretend that I'm not afraid of moments. The boys and I talk about this all the time. Laramie and I talk about this all the time. Like, it's okay to be afraid of a situation, but it's not okay for you to like let that fear affect you in like any real way or preventative way. You just gotta fucking go. Just go. Just do it. You're scared. I get it. Fucking, but go.
So, you know what I heard you say is, I don't want to pretend.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. That's great.
Okay.
Right? I know you think I'm from another planet, but like, I don't want to pretend.
Yeah.
What does it mean to keep it real to you?
it just means to just be honest. That's all it is. That's all that keeping it real is. Just be honest and do the stuff your heart is telling you to do or your brain is telling you to do.
Do you lead with your heart or your mind?
Probably depends on the situation. Like, professionally, mostly my mind. Occasionally my heart will get in there. And you know, grab the steering wheel, but mostly it's by my brain. And then with my, you know, with Laramie or with the boys, it's the opposite. I'm just like, let me just hug you. Let me just kiss on your forehead for a minute.
What mental skills or mindset skills do you use to deal with very difficult, emotionally charged moments?
Usually it flows like in a very predictable pattern. If something terrible happens, whatever it is, just a thing that makes me feel not good. It could be something that happened to somebody else or a thing that happened to me or somebody in my family or just like a thing didn't turn out the way I wanted it to turn out or had hoped that it would turn out. Usually the pattern is, I like, we'll see the thing on a screen somewhere. Let's say I got it rejected I pitched a movie and they decided after all they didn't want it. And I read the email from the agent, and the agent is like, nah, they decided they're going against it. And then I get sad because I've been working on this thing for 3 months. And then I go in my bedroom and I like lay in the bed for a few minutes and I look at my phone and I just sort of scroll endlessly and don't do anything at all, but just be sad for however long that lasts, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is. And then I take a breath and then I get out of the bed and then I go find Laramie and then I start talking to her. And then I realize like, we'll just try another thing. This happened. Let's figure out what the next thing is. And then you just go do it again. And it's the same thing with like life stuff. A sucky thing happens and you like feel bad about it for a bit and you let it sit with you. And then you're like, all right, what can I do so that this doesn't happen again? And usually it's like a very predictable or an easy answer to find. Sometimes it's not. Like the stuff that really gets you, the stuff that really gets me is the stuff that I can't control. Like if I could be having just the best day at work. I got all the right emails I wanted. I got all of the good tweets I wanted. I check my like sales numbers and they're all good and I'm feeling great. And then I come home and then like my youngest son tells me he had a bad day at school and like somebody said a thing to him and now he's sad. And like as soon as that happens, it just fucking everything falls apart again. And you just have to sit there and like just be sad with your kid for a little while or whatever. And then like, you know, it goes away eventually. And that's how it works for like all of this stuff. It will, that badness will go away eventually. And then you like try again. And there you go. That's the whole thing.
It's awesome. So this is what I hear you saying is like, I feel emotions and I don't run from, I feel yeah. emotions.
Yeah. You gotta allow yourself that airspace to like feel whatever it is you're feeling, because oftentimes the emotions that you're having, even if they're not correct, they're usually like not supposed to be correct. They're just like things you're feeling and you just got to get them out of your body, if that makes sense. Yeah. And then once they're out, then you feel better.
Actually, it's really good research. What you're just eloquently, from a very applied practical standpoint, you're saying, this is how I do it. This is how it makes sense. You're standing mm-hmm. right on the shoulders of great research, which is if you can name awesome. An emotion, uh-huh. Just the fact of naming it actually changes it. It dilutes yeah. it just a little bit. It just kind of lets the edges of the container be more porous. And then it's the beginning process of moving through it. And so just naming it changes it, which is really cool. Yeah, that's right. Emotional intelligence, by the way, right? Like that's a there part of emotional intelligence. Yeah.
See, so Laramie is going to school for therapy, so... I'm like getting all of it. Yeah. She's like a proper therapist.
Yeah, that's what's up. Okay, there you go.
I'm cheating on this test here that you're giving me.
you actually know. Okay. So let's go grand for a moment. How do you finish this thought? It all comes down to...
What comes down to? What are we talking
it.
About?
Yeah, it. It all comes down to...
It all comes down to grit. I'm gonna pick grit because it rhymes, and I like it. All comes down to grit. That's great. That like, I see that. Listen, I see that on the when you play like middle school or high school sports, and they always like have a saying painted above the door that you slap on your way out to like the field or the that's it. All begins with grit. I could see that painted on in a seventh grade locker room.
So how about this? Is that the world's leading researcher on grit, Angela Duckworth, she has found that it is actually one of the more significant predictors of success, of achievement.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Percentage of the people, small percentage, super talented. You're never going to catch them. You're never going to be as good at basketball as LeBron James. But, you know, all the rest of them, you got a shot. You got a chance. Just fucking outwork them.
Well, okay. Well, let's talk about talent. Like, let's talk about LeBron James and Westbrook and fill in the blanks. The tip of the arrow folks. What's your take on them? And I know that's a big question, but what is your take on like how they organize their life? Because you've been studying, you've been watching. Like, how do they organize their life?
I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating for somebody to be as good at a thing as LeBron is at basketball or Russell Westbrook is at basketball. You're talking about on the entire planet, these guys are in the very top. They're in the room with like that have the 10 seats or whatever. Pick the 10 greatest basketball players alive right now. And it's just crazy to me to think that somebody can be that good at a thing, because you can't, it can't just be like a certain level of talent. You have to not only have that talent, but you also have to like have the other part of it too. You have to be willing to do all of the work, which is how you end up with like the videos of LeBron in the off season at like 4 a.m. doing whatever. Like he's working harder than everybody else, and also he's just better than everybody else. That's a crazy combination. I think anybody at the top of their field is doing probably a version of that. And that to me is really, really interesting.
How do you work? What do you do to sharpen your sword, to, you know, refine your craft?
I just fucking sit at the computer and type into it all of the time. I try to read as much as possible. I identified a few of the writers earlier. I always read their stuff, or like I'm trying to find other people who are writing in ways that are interesting, and just sitting there typing and hoping it works out.
Mm. Do you have structure in the way that you write?
Yeah, I have a lot of structure. My whole day is structured.
It is. Yeah. Okay. And then do you have structure in the paragraphs or pages or passages that you write, or is it a bit more formless?
No, I have structure going in. I think generally speaking, if I'm writing anything at all, there's like a reason I'm writing it. There's like a central point that I'm trying to make. And it can be something very direct. Like when I wrote the basketball book, one of the chapters, the first chapter in the book, it says, okay, Michael Jordan, we're going to like not argue about this. Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player of all time. Let's just assume everybody feels that way. All right, cool. What version of Michael Jordan is the best version of Michael Jordan we've ever seen? And then it was like, all right, let me compare all of the years Michael Jordan played basketball and figure out which of these was the most devastating. When was he at his absolute best? Like that's like an easy thing to chase down because you just have some numbers. But it starts out very clearly, this is the point I'm trying to make. So every sentence that I write should help me arrive at that point. If it doesn't help me arrive to that point, then I just delete it and keep moving, right? I'm just like carving until I get to where I'm trying to go. It's the same thing with anything that I write. There's always like a central thing that I'm writing my way toward. And sometimes you state it specifically, other times you don't. I just wrote a short story that'll come out on July 15, and I do not state in there what like the reason is for me writing the story or what the point is I'm trying to make. But probably if you read it in the back of your brain, you're going to go like, oh, okay, I understand, because the sentences will lead you there. But that's the path that I'm taking whenever I'm writing something. Identify this thing, cool, write your way toward it.
Okay. So for you, the key for success is, or a key of success is?
Just outwork them. That's what I'm going to keep coming back to. That's like that's my only trick. That's my only real skill.
What is, as a writer, is there a favorite phrase that is guiding you right now? Or maybe it's a lyric, maybe it's something you made up, or it's a bit of poetry. You know, is there something that helps guide you?
I can think of probably like 50 different ones. Almost all of them are from music or like a thing somebody said, like whatever. Robert De Niro's character in Goodfellas, there's like a part where he tells a kid, you know, don't take no shit from nobody, something like that. This is when Joe Pesci's character shoots Spider, and Spider tells him afterward, after he shoots him in the foot, he like heals up, and then tells him, go fuck yourself. And then they make a big fuss about it, whatever, stuff like that. Like you grab a hold of little things and then, you know, draw whatever strength you can from them. There's a rapper that I really like. His name is Cousin Stiz. This is a kid out of Boston. I started listening to the year 2015, the year when the place where I was working got shut down. And like, I came across his music, and it was really, to me, inspiring. But he was always saying like one or two things in each of the albums that really jumped out at me. He has one line, it's very simple, but he's just screaming it. I remember when you doubted me. And like, that's great. I love that. There's some other ones where he's like, don't tell him your plans, just believe in them and go. Shit like that. Jay-Z has a line where he's like, oh, you don't take shit, or they don't believe you. Cool, me neither. Like, let's go Make the World Believe Us, or a version of that. I was just listening to that album today. But there's always, yeah, there's, they're all sort of following the same underdog theme of like, just, you know, you gotta just do it. Somebody's gonna get to do the thing you wanna do. So fucking, it might as well be you.
If you were to ask 20 people, you know, for your three words that describe you, do you think you'd be surprised by those three words?
Absolutely not. If you ask Twitter to describe me in three words, the three words you're going to get, shoot your shot, which is like a phrase that we say all of the time. And it's just like, just try to do the thing you want to do. But that's been like a running theme for years at this point, which I stole it from a student of mine. I mean, not even a student of mine. I stole it from a student at the school when I was teaching. It was like the most inspiring thing that I had ever seen. I'll tell you this story. It's a very quick story, but this was Valentine's Day. And you know, Valentine's Day at a middle school is like a very exciting time. You've got kids walking around with like flowers they're going to give, or like a teddy bear or chocolates or whatever. Oftentimes you will have situations where a kid is like, this is the time that they're going to make their move and they're going to tell somebody that they like them. And that was the case with this one particular student. We were passing in between classes. Let's say it's between third and fourth period or whatever. So I'm standing at my door, because that's what you do when you're the teacher, to make sure, number one, that no kids are fighting in the hallway, but also number two, to like greet the kids as they're coming in. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Can't wait to teach you today, blah, blah, blah. So I'm standing there at the door. The kids are coming in. I see this kid walking down the hallway, and he's carrying a Valentine's Day bundle. It's like a bear and flowers and chocolate or whatever. And he walks up to this girl, and this is happening, you know, several feet in front of me, and he hands it to her. And she looks at it, and she looks at him, and then she like shakes her head no, and she gives it back to him and walks away. And I was like crushed for this poor young man that he had just had his heart broken. I was like, I can't even imagine how terrible you must feel. I'm so glad that I'm not like your father, and I have to deal with this, the emotional like turbulence of this moment. I was like, I was expecting for this to be a catastrophic event for this young man. And he like turns to walk away, and I'm staring at him just like eyes as big as cue balls, just like, oh man, that's, I'm so sorry. I can't find it in me to say any words, but I'm looking at him, and he looks at me, and he sees me looking at him, and he realizes I've just watched this exchange. And all he does, I'll never forget it forever, is he shrugs his shoulders and he says, shooters shoot. And then he walked away, and I was like, holy fucking shit. This is like my life philosophy from here going forward. Shooters shoot. He did not care a bit. If he did care, he didn't show it. He shrugged it off and just kept on about his day. And I was like, that's it. This is the young man that I want to be like when I become an adult.
In many ways, you're an epitome for this concept that I'm trying to understand, FOPO, fear of people's opinions. Mm-hmm. You're living it. That kid taught it to you.
He did.
Right. Yeah.
I'll never forget it.
That is awesome. Can I share my experience with you?
Please, please do.
Highly intelligent. Off access. So you see things differently, you know? Mm-hmm. There's an irreverence that comes with it, but it's truly just an authenticity. And mm-hmm. your emotional part of life is, it sounds too simple to say a lover, but you've got big capacity for emotions. So I see you as like highly intelligent, off access and authentic, and a lover. Yeah. And so I've really enjoyed this conversation. You know, so thank you for reminding me like of those core attributes and values. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I know you want to, you know, the humility of saying, just some hard worker, you got some serious assets, you know? And so it's, you know, I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for saying nice things.
Okay. Where can people follow and be part of what you're doing?
They can just, I'm mostly on Twitter. It's just my name, Shea Serrano. And you will very quickly see that I am not a genius of any sort. I'm just a fucking Mexican with an internet connection. That's all that it is.
Oh, God. Sure, I appreciate you. Thank you for this.
And all right, homie.
Yeah, if there's, and I want to make sure people go get your books, right?
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's make sure that that happens as well, right?
Yeah, go get those books because that's how I pay for all of everything.
I appreciate you.
All right, later.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.